We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. For centuries, explorers tried and failed to find a way to sail from the Atlantic to the Pacific by going across the top of the world. Now, climate change may actually make it possible to do just that, creating new opportunities for commercial shipping and also for oil and gas exploration. But it also sets the stage for conflict, at least potential conflict, between the nations who make claims on the waters of the Arctic. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about the global security implications of an ice-free Arctic. And our guest for the program is Klaus Dodds. He's professor of geopolitics in the Department of Geography at University of London. And he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a symposium on the topic Global Security, Climate Change, and the Arctic Implications of an Open Northwest Passage. This is taking place today in the afternoon, and it is jointly sponsored by, organized by the European Union Center, the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and also the Russian East European and Eurasian Center here at the University of Illinois. And there are a number of speakers that will be taking part. This is happening this afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Illini Union on Green Street. And I would certainly imagine that anybody who is interested in stopping by would be welcome, should feel welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Klaus Dodds does research in the areas of geopolitics, media, and the international governance of the Antarctic and the Arctic, and he has published 5 books dealing with these subjects. And we're very pleased that he could be here and spend some time talking with us. Questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So again, here locally, 333-9455, but also toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
I think this is a fascinating area, one that is getting increasing attention for the reason that we stated. One of the implications of global climate change has been the melting of the ice in the Arctic Ocean. And in fact, I think at least one scientist, someone who actually happens to be at Cambridge recently, I think made some news because he predicted that, in fact, within 20 years that the Arctic Ocean will be free of ice in the summertime. And I suppose there are some other people who have said, well, maybe that maybe it will take a little longer. But essentially, there seems to be a good deal of agreement, which makes it possible now to do what people have wanted to do for a long time, and that is to find an easier and more direct route from one ocean to the other.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think what we're looking at here is a kind of a cultural change as much as a geopolitical one. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in the 19th century, a lot of people, including Americans, sort of speculated that, you know, one day there might be a kind of polar sea that was kind of magically would be free of ice. And everybody was saying, well, you're ridiculous. You know, how can this be so? People have tried to find the Northwest Passage. They get stuck in the ice. And the case of Sir John Franklin and his crew in the 19th century just perish. I think what's happening now is that, in a sense, human beings and industrialization and everything that goes with it, I mean, they're the ones threatening the ice, whereas in the 19th century, the ice was seen as threatening to humans. Mm-hmm. So we've had this kind of complete shift. And, of course, with scientists increasingly predicting that the Arctic is going to be ice-free in the next 2 to 3 decades, during the summer season in particular, then I think what this has done is to unleash lots of speculation about, well, what kind of Arctic are we going to have in the not-too-distant future.
Mm. And certainly that it has caused concern among environmentalists. That here, maybe this is another set of issues that's connected here, among environmentalists concerned about what it would mean for the Arctic if now we had freighters regularly passing through, or we had exploration for oil and gas. And I think that there are some people who suggest that a very significant portion of the world's oil and gas, untapped oil and gas reserves, are there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's absolutely right. I mean, obviously, there's been oil and gas exploration, as Alaska demonstrates, for the last 30-odd years. I think what environmentalists, but also we shouldn't forget indigenous peoples, are concerned about is that, look, if we're going to get all this enhanced hydrocarbon exploitation, increased commercial shipping, then there is further danger that these very vulnerable environments are going to be, you know, undermined and threatened. And the other thing to note is that there's, as indigenous groups will tell you, particularly in Alaska, there's been growing problems with winter storms. And this has been really disruptive to most coastal communities. And we've got also with, for example, the permafrost becoming less firm, there's been further infrastructural disruption. And so life in the high Arctic is getting tougher for many communities, particularly in Alaska and Canada.
Yeah. Is it possible to say something about, in real terms, say, let us just say for commercial shipping, what it would really mean to, rather than having to, say, go through the Panama Canal or go all the way down the coast of South America down to the tip and around the other side, to be able to take this shorter route?
Well, we are talking about two key things. One is that the number of shipping days would unquestionably be shortened. And the other issue, of course, which is that there'd be less oil, diesel, being burnt by ships as a consequence. So you could argue there is a kind of saving here, not just measured in days, but also in terms of fuel consumption. But I also wouldn't kind of over-exaggerate this. I mean, there have been recent transits by commercial ships using the Northern Sea Route, for example. But, I mean, that was only possible because icebreakers were on hand to help and assist those particular ships. So what we're really talking about is informed speculation. Mm-hmm. You know, if the ice does get thinner, are we likely to see more ships using the route? And I think the answer is yes. But before that happens, a great deal more infrastructural investment would be needed in order for those ships to safely cross through the Northwest Passage, and there are about seven transit opportunities, alongside, of course, the Northern Sea Route. So this is something that is, you know, in a sense, is a longer-term ambition.
Well, this precisely is one of the questions that I wanted to raise because, for example, there was a recent story about a couple of ships, I believe that they were German ships, and that they went from Vladivostok in Russia to Rotterdam by this route, and that would seem to be, you know, sort of the first of what might likely to be a lot of trips, except for the fact that they did, for part of this trip, require the assistance of a Russian icebreaker. So someone raised this question, well, was that just kind of a stunt? And whether or not we should we actually expect that in time, and maybe not all that far in the future, that would become more of a routine thing, or are we maybe making too much of this?
I mean, I think my reaction is it might become more of a routine, and I think the might is the key thing here. I think the danger is sometimes is that, you know, certain newspapers and media organizations pick up on a story and say, well, look, you know, this is the future. And again, I would just caution that, because that particular voyage was a lengthy one. It required all kinds of assistance. But on the other hand, it also was, in terms of the stunt, quite a useful one for the Russian authorities, because it kind of reminds everybody that that so-called Northern Sea Route falls largely within Russian territorial waters, or certainly within the kind of Russian maritime domain. So from the Russian point of view, you know, they want to say, look, you know, if you want to use this, fine, up to a point. But we're also going to make sure that we help to regulate and control this kind of movement. Mm. Now, looking the other side of the Arctic, from the Canadian point of view, this is actually quite problematic, because the Canadians have always viewed the Northwest Passage as part of their internal waters. And what they're very reluctant to do is to say, hey, it's a free-for-all. You know, treat the Northwest Passage as an international strait, and all the rights of so-called innocent passage kind of follow. Mm-hmm. And that's a view that the United States and the European Union share. So this issue of commercial shipping will inevitably have geopolitical consequences.
And I guess, and just to be clear, people should understand that here we're actually talking about two different routes. One, the thing that we're calling the Northwest Passage runs through Canada. And here, maybe one of the issues is, you know, competing sorts of claims and concerns between Canada and the United States. And then we have the more northerly passage through the Arctic Sea, which may or may not become possible depending on what happens with the ice. And there, maybe one of the complicating factors is that we have a number of nations whose coasts are actually on the Arctic Sea, who by virtue of the law of the sea that says you can claim so much water off of your coast, we have Russia, United States, Canada, Denmark, and Norway. All of them actually have coastlines on the sea, so all of them would have some standing to make a claim over some of it because of that. And so here, you're going to get into the possibility that there, you know, might be some conflict, or at least there would be issues of use that would have to get worked out among these competing nations that have some basis for claim.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, and this is where this whole notion of the ice-free Arctic throws up these kinds of tensions. Mm-hmm. Look, I mean, really, essentially, when the ice was, considered solid and considered to be a barrier to movement, so many of these debates, frankly, didn't have a great deal of salience. Now, with the ice becoming less of apparent, barrier or impediment to movement, so, of course, it's thrown up, as I say, all these anxieties and controversies about control and access. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Canada, with regard to the Northwest Passage, which has a particular sensitivity in this context, to be blunt, the ice was the best ally Canada had. Now that it's going, it's not quite gone, but it appears to be going, of course, other nations, other commercial actors, are looking at the Northwest Passage in different kinds of ways. And to be blunt, people do not expect to suffer the same fate as Franklin. They don't expect anymore to get stuck in the ice mm-hmm. and left there for 2 years. We're talking about a very different kind of world, I think.
Well, isn't it, though, at least clear, very clear that as far as the Northwest Passage is concerned, we're talking about waters that clearly are Canadian territorial waters, so should not the government of Canada be able to say without much chance of being challenged, well, this is what will or will not happen?
Well, I think the problem is, of course, is that the analysis the Canadian government or governments have consistently made is not necessarily shared by international lawyers from other countries. Mm-hmm. And so really what has happened over the last 40-odd years is that the United States and Canada have essentially agreed to differ. They've rubbed along with one another. And both, for different reasons, have really come to the conclusion it's probably not worth having a major dispute over. During the Cold War, submarines in particular routinely transited through the Northwest Passage and other areas of the North American mm-hmm. Arctic. What I think has now come to the fore is that if the Arctic does indeed become more accessible, so this argument about the Northwest Passage becomes more globalized. So increasingly the European Union, China, Britain, commercial actors will, get involved in the debate. Mm-hmm. And I think what the Canadians cannot rely on anymore is that something that was comparatively a bilateral issue between America and themselves, that will no longer hold. And what they're going to have to do is come really to a more public kind of understanding of the Northwest Passage. And frankly, my feeling is that the Canadians are going to find that their view will not be widely shared. Yeah.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Professor Klaus Dodds. He is professor in the Department of Geography at University of London. And among other things, he's interested in the international governance of both the Antarctic and the Arctic. And he's here to take part in a symposium looking at some of the global security issues raised by climate change and the fact that some people believe, as a result of the melting of ice, that it would be increasingly possible to do commercial shipping either through the now famous Northwest Passage, the one that goes through Canada, or one even further north, a way of sailing through the Arctic Sea over the top of the world, and how the competing claims of the various countries here will be met and negotiated is something that sort of remains to be seen. That's what we're talking about here. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Something that I thought was interesting and I'd like to have you talk about is the fact that when we're talking about the Antarctic, the South Pole, there is actually a treaty barring anybody claiming it. There isn't anything like that for the North Pole, and I guess I'm a bit curious about how it is that such a thing got worked out for the Antarctic, but there is no parallel sort of agreement for the North.
Well, in 1959, a treaty was signed for the Antarctic, and the key thing to bear in mind is that seven countries do make a claim to the Antarctic, including Britain. America and Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time, only signed the treaty because essentially what the treaty enables is them to make a claim to the Antarctic in due course if the treaty ever collapses. So there was a kind of, it's a terrible pun, I know, but a territorial freezing that was made possible because of that treaty. Now, will an Arctic treaty be developed with a similar kind of principle at stake, which is a sort of territorial status quo? The answer is no. The five Arctic coastal states, you've already mentioned them, including America and Russia, they don't want a treaty. Why would they want a treaty? Because the thing that the Antarctic Treaty does is to say to both the claimant states and those who do not make a claim, we can all come and work together in the Antarctic, we can carry out our scientific research, we can engage in tourism or fishing or whatever it might be, but we also agree not to mine or exploit the Antarctic. I mean, that works for the Antarctic, partly because there's no indigenous human population as well. In the Arctic, the last thing the Arctic coastal states really want is more people, more states, more organizations becoming involved unless they control it. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen over the last year in particular is the five Arctic coastal states, I call them the A5. It's a bit like the G7. This is the A5. They're essentially trying to muscle in and to say to other interested parties, the Arctic is ours, and we don't really want you getting too involved. And this has caused all kinds of tensions between other nearby Arctic states like Iceland, Sweden, Finland. But it's also created tensions between China, the European Union, and the Arctic Five because, you know, they come to the Arctic with rather different kinds of understandings. You know, for them, the Arctic is a kind of open space where, for example, they emphasize things like accessibility. For the Arctic Five, what they want to emphasize is control, administration, their authority. And so I can absolutely guarantee you that the Arctic Five do not want an Arctic treaty, that there is absolutely no incentive for them to develop one.
Mm. One wonders whether there would have been as much willingness for there to be a treaty on the Antarctic if at the time anybody really thought that commercial exploitation of whatever resources were there was practically possible.
Well, they certainly fantasized about commercial exploitation. I mean, one of the things the Antarctic Treaty does not do in 1959 is to talk about resources. And the reason they didn't talk about resources because they knew that as soon as they mentioned the resource word, you have to tackle the issue of sovereignty and ownership. Now, in 1959, and after all, remember, we were at the height of the Cold War. Both the United States and the Soviet Union came to the conclusion that they didn't really want the Antarctic to be an active theater of conflict or strife. So the treaty is a masterstroke of diplomatic fudge. You know, they say we're not going to try and resolve anything. We don't resolve who owns the Antarctic, but we'll use science as a mechanism to foster cooperation. Now, in the Arctic, you just don't have that luxury. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about 50 years on. You're quite right that, you know, our commercial understanding of the Arctic has changed. We've got all kinds of technological change. We don't have a Cold War conflict, but we certainly have tension. And so in a way, I'm very suspicious of people who say, can't we just look to the Antarctic experience and transfer it to the Arctic? I just don't think it's as simple as that.
Yeah. Well, and it also makes one wonder about this now peaceful coexistence to responsibly manage, study, and otherwise take care of and not overly exploit the Antarctic. It actually makes it sound that that's not on very solid ground. That's potentially fragile. That if someone thought it was in their interest to say, well, you know, we'd like to have a different sort of agreement, that actually could happen.
Treaties, you know, to a certain extent, that if they endure and survive, they do so on the basis partly of mutual trust, but also partly playing out the lowest common denominator. And so what's happened in the Antarctic Treaty system, as it's called, is that to a certain extent, all the participants have agreed at times to turn a blind eye, for example, you know, when things go on that they don't necessarily approve of. And what the treaty demands is consensus. And the only way you secure consensus is by partly give and take, but also setting the bar sufficiently low that everybody can kind of meet the standards. Mm-hmm. The key thing also about treaties to remember is treaties only cover signatories. And what's happened in the Antarctic is we've had a growing role of so-called third parties, that is, people not signed up to the treaty, you know, doing their own thing. And so the kind of the challenge is how do you hold the parties together? And one of the things that they've chosen to do, which I think was very wise in the 1990s, was to say, we are not going to allow mining in the Antarctic. And something called the Protocol on Environmental Protection says, we're going to focus on environmental protection. We're going to continue science. We're going to allow certain activities like tourism and fishing. But please, can everybody not talk about oil, gas, uranium, iron, or coal? Because if we do that, we will get to the question that we cannot answer. Who owns the Antarctic?
Mm. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there were these five countries who had coast on the Arctic Sea, the Arctic Five, so which again are Russia, the United States, Canada, Denmark, Norway, that have some basis for a claim based on this idea, the law of the sea, that says you're entitled to claim 200 miles out from your coastline. And then there are these three other countries, who Sweden, Finland, and Iceland, who have reason to think about this as being kind of in their sphere of interest. They don't quite have the same claim as the other countries, but that they're players. Or at least feel that they should be players. How does that complicate things? And do they in fact have much standing to make a claim?
Well, the truth of the matter is, in terms of the Arctic Ocean, there are these Arctic Five. And what is absolutely infuriating for Iceland and Sweden and Finland is, in essence, even with their exclusive economic zones, and of course, really, we're talking about Iceland here, Sweden and Finland, you know, they don't have an Arctic coastline. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately for them, physical geography is not in their favor. And what they find so annoying is that they say, look, we're also part of this government body called the Arctic Council. But increasingly, you five, because of physical geography and the law of the sea, of course, that then invests importance in that, mm-hmm. you're taking these kind of decisions, you're plotting, you're strategizing, and we're being excluded. And so what you're seeing here is a number of schisms opening up between different parties and their different kinds of relationships to the Arctic. So I think just as the Antarctic has a basic tension between claimant states and non-claimant states, You're seeing that increasingly in the Arctic, but with different kinds of ramifications.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Klaus Dodds. Again, he's a professor of geography at University of London, and he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in a symposium talking about these very issues taking place this afternoon. It's been organized by the folks at the European Union Center, the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security, and also the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center. And questions are welcome. We have someone here who would like to join in the conversation. Others can certainly do that by calling 333-9455. That's the number if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi. This is a fascinating topic, and I'm perhaps taking a shot in the dark because I'm vaguely remembering an issue I either read of or heard of the media concerning the United States' rights in this dispute over the Arctic. And that had something to do, if my memory serves me correctly, with the fact that the United States' rights were not as solid legally as they could be if the United States signed off or would become a signatory to the law of the sea. Does the law of the sea have anything to do with this and the fact the United States is not a signatory to the law of the sea?
That's a great question, and I think your memory is not playing tricks on you. Essentially, as you know, for a treaty to enter into force in the U.S. context, the Senate is a key player here. When the law of the sea was negotiated in the 1980s, essentially the American position was, we do not accept the law of the sea for one particular reason, amongst others, which was they did not like the role that the United Nations was given through the International Seabed Authority with regards to the deep seabed and whether it was a common heritage of humankind. And because of that kind of fundamental objection to the, you might call the United Nations role in the seas, the U.S. has not ratified the law of the sea. President Bush, in one of the last things he did before he left office, issued a presidential directive and said, look, we have got to get serious here. We have got to ratify this law of the sea. And the Obama administration, I think, has picked up this and realizes, you know, there's a work to be done here. The thing is this, even if the U.S. has not ratified the law of the sea, by the sheer fact that the state of Alaska is part of the U.S., you know, there is exclusive economic zone, there is an outer continental shelf that can in due course be delimited and claimed. And actually what's happening at the moment is the U.S., through its extended continental shelf project, has been busily mapping anyway the ocean seabed all around U.S. territories. So in essence, once that treaty is ratified by the Senate, the U.S. is good to go.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And this, I guess, just introduces a further little complication here or interesting point, that the law of the sea says that you're entitled to claim 200 miles out from your coastline the territorial waters. But there's also this little wrinkle that says, well, though also whatever you can claim for your continental shelf, that is under, you know, the seabed, under the water, if you can make the claim that it goes out more than 200 miles, you can have more than 200 miles. Or you could say, well, what's under there, whatever it is, that belongs to us. So here I'm sure that again, that the countries we're talking about, the Arctic Five, I'm sure would like to do that as well, like to say that their sovereignty by virtue of their continental shelves should extend more than 200 miles out from their coastline.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, all five of the Arctic coastal states are busily mapping the Arctic seabed. And it's kind of funny because you've got a juxtaposition here between, you know, above the surface, everybody is worrying about the melting ice. Below the surface, reassuringly, the seabed looks a little bit more stable. And so what they're doing is they're all trying to map it, and they're all going to go to the UN body called the Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf and say, this is ours. You know, this bit of seabed beyond the exclusive economic zone, which is 200 nautical miles from the coastline, belongs to us. And what you've seen over the last, well, I guess 8 or 9 years now, is a whole series of endeavors to to map that seabed. And all the countries, including the U.S., are spending, you know, millions of dollars, rubles, krona, trying to map the seabed. And they're going to present their results to the commission and say, there we are. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to hope that the commission is going to say, through a recommendation, yeah, you're right. Now, the point to remember is that the commission only issues recommendations. So it can say, look, we think this bit might be yours. But in essence, the commission also says, if you've got neighboring states, it is up to you to resolve any conflicts that may exist mm-hmm. over this mapping and subsequently claiming of, say, resource rights.
So this it leads to this very interesting situation where the Arctic Five are sort of throwing elbows at each other because they have competing claims and want to get as much as they can. And yet at the same time, it's in the interest of the Arctic Five to try to hang together against the rest of the world who also might like to make claims and say something like, well, this really truly should be an international resource that should be protected in the interests of all and that, you know, there should be some opportunity for development of the resource by somebody other than just the Arctic Five.
Yeah, I mean, that's very nicely put because I think you accurately summarize the implicit tension. The Arctic Five are an exclusive little club. Mm-hmm. And like all good clubs, there are certain rules of behavior. And one rule of behavior is that wherever possible, you, in a sense, internalize disputes and tension. What you don't do, if you can avoid it, is to reveal to the world that actually there's a great deal of disagreement, which there is, between the five of them. So, for example, in the Beaufort Sea, America and Canada continue to argue about a common boundary. Norway and Russia continue to have issues over the Barents Sea. The most ridiculous and the funniest one is between Denmark, which is the controlling power of Greenland, and Canada. They still argue about an uninhabited island called Hans. And so you have all these disputes that are, you know, comparatively well known to people who study this area. But they don't necessarily want this publicized more widely, because what they want to say to the world is, we're going to sort it out ourselves. You can just all take a back seat, and we'll let you know when we're ready.
Yeah. Is it the case that these countries are, or are these countries, particularly, I guess I'm thinking of the Arctic Five again, increasing their military presence in this area?
Yeah, I mean, what all the Arctic Five do and have done is to use a number of different mechanisms. So one of the things that matters here is science. So there's both a kind of civil and a military dimension, and the two work together. And the way in which they work together, for example, is that scientists who want to work, say, in various parts of the Arctic may well get transported there by, say, icebreakers. The Canadian government, for example, has said very publicly it wants to increase its presence in the Arctic, including a military presence, particularly places like Alert. But they've also done so in response to concerns of growing Russian endeavors in the Arctic. One of the ways that the Russians have responded to heightened interest in the Arctic is to renew long-range bomber flying. And so this has then provoked concerns in Canada and the United States, particularly Canada, about overflying. There's also growing interest in investing again in a new generation of submarines. All the Arctic Five have had various debates about shipping, particularly icebreaking capacity. So there's lots of evidence, in other words, alongside, of course, NATO's growing interest in the Arctic, that we're witnessing, I think, a trend that was being reversed in the 1990s, which was the demilitarization of the Arctic. We're looking increasingly at a remilitarization.
Yeah, very interesting. We are moving into about our last 15 minutes. In this hour of Focus 580, our guest is Professor Klaus Dodds. He's professor of geography in the Department of Geography, professor of geopolitics at the University of London. And he's here visiting the campus. He's visiting to take part in a symposium dealing with these very issues, some of the global security issues that are the result of the opening up of the Northwest Passage, the Northeast Passage, as it's sometimes called, up through the Arctic and then through Canada. something that people had thought about and looked for a long time. And as a result of melting of the ice, it looks like it may be possible to do just that, to sail across one or both of these places. And it raises some issues that connect with the various competing claims of the countries to these waters. There is maybe some potential for conflict there. Questions are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. Where do you think that this is going? Obviously, there are reasons particularly for the Arctic Five to try to work this out. And internationally, of course, there are concerns, or a variety of concerns about this area. Where do you think that this whole conversation is going?
Well, I don't think, everybody knows futurology is a dangerous game. I think many people predicted the ending of the Cold War in 1989. I don't think we're going to lead necessarily to outright conflict between the Arctic Five and, say, others. What I do think is going to happen is that there is going to be a period of growing tension between the various kind of actors who are interested in the Arctic. I think we're going to have growing pressure to develop new regimes of governance to deal with issues like fishing, like mm-hmm. tourism, like commercial shipping routes, that kind of thing. And we're going to find, I'm afraid, that the Arctic becomes further embedded in a whole series of international and regional governance regimes. But I think fundamentally, the thing to watch is how the Arctic Five behave with one another and how the Arctic Ocean will eventually be mapped and delimited. And that, in part, will determine the extent of, if you like, extraterritorial involvement. Because once those outer continental shelf claims are kind of fixed and mutually agreed, then we'll know, for example, whether there's any so-called deep seabed, which will have common heritage implications, and we'll begin to see how the Arctic may or may not, for example, be subject to more oil and gas exploitation. Mm. But the point I think really I'd want to leave listeners with is that whilst we talk about, you know, oil and gas and the next showdown, a lot of the potential that exists is to be found within the exclusive economic zones of those Arctic coastal states. And nobody contests the sovereignty of those kinds of things. So I think, you know, those who are looking to Arctic conflict, I think I talk about Arctic tension. Mm. I don't think we're going to have conflict here.
And so then the answer to the question, once the countries manage to finish working out their competing claims about what's their territory, then truly we really don't know how much international water might actually be left, which maybe wouldn't give the rest of the world that much basis for making a claim. If the Arctic Five can in a sense sew up most of the water for themselves, so the rest of the world really won't have much to come along and say, well, here there's something here that's left over that belongs to everybody.
Well, I think the key distinction is between, if you like, water and seabed. So that's the really important one. Whatever happens regards the Arctic Five, rights of innocent passage don't suddenly disappear. Mm. So mobility, I think, is one issue, accessibility. On the other hand, though, there is the kind of the resource question. I mean, in an ideal world, I have to say, we would be so committed to a low-carbon future, we would have got ourselves off the addiction that is oil and gas, that actually perhaps we could look to the Arctic and say, thank God, we didn't actually have to drill further for oil and gas. And maybe also that will mean that we don't look to the Antarctic and say, let's also get the oil and gas that undoubtedly exists, even if we don't know the actual potential. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I kind of hope that the next 20 or 30 years will be a kind of wake-up call. And everybody will say, look, if we're serious about climate change, you know, if we're serious about reducing our damaging dependency on hydrocarbons, then maybe what we should try and say is, let's not further exploit these kind of areas. And maybe that will be an epitaph for kind of humanity's attempt to come to its collective senses.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Bloomington, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you. Very interesting. You may have covered this. I'm sorry if I missed it, but I was wondering two things. What damage is really done? I've read some things, but with the drilling in those areas. And two, number two, excuse me, I keep reading that the melting is very bad on the animals, the polar bears and others. I guess the best thing is maybe Canada quit beating their seals to death. But anyway, what kind of destruction is it going to cause the animals and the earth when they, if they, with the the animals with the melting and the earth with the drilling?
Well, is that something you can talk about?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I think those are great questions. With regards to drilling and hydrocarbon exploitation, I mean, there are lots of ways of kind of tackling this big issue. I mean, one is to say what oil and gas companies will try and do is they'll say, look, you know, we may have been bad operators 30 years ago, but if you come up now and see our operations, you'll see how clean we do things, how efficient we are, and the kind of minimal impact. Now, I'm utterly unpersuaded by that kind of attempt to retrospectively justify what happened in the last 30 years. The point is this: however clean and minimal the impact might appear visually, this is still, of course, contributing to this hydrocarbon addiction that we are now persuaded, most of us anyway, that is leading to global climate change. In terms of other local impacts, I mean, apart from environmental degradation, one of the things that indigenous peoples up in the high north in Canada and Alaska are really worried about is, for example, seismic surveying, which indigenous communities, particularly in northern Alaska, say is interfering, for example, with whale migration. And that, in turn, is making it harder for those communities to engage in traditional lifestyles, including whale hunting. So that would be kind of one aspect. The other, which, of course, depends partly on your point of view, of course, revolves around, as you said, sealing practices. And again, what I think is happening here is trying to understand how, for example, large-scale commercial development is interfering with both traditional and more commercial lifestyle and exploitation patterns. Sorry, just remind me again, what was the second part of your question?
Well, what is the melting doing? I keep reading that the polar bears are drowning, and yeah. What is the melting doing with the animal population?
Yeah, thanks very much. I think what's happening there is I'd make a distinction between animals like the polar bear that, for example, depend on sea ice for hunting, and then other animals that are more sort of land-based, like, for example, reindeer or caribou.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happening with the polar bear is that there is mounting concern that its capacity, for example, to hunt seals is being compromised because sea ice cover from the coastline and beyond is becoming more unpredictable. And you also find, if you talk to indigenous communities, a really common complaint is that the weather is strange and that we're finding it harder and harder to predict conditions, you know, notwithstanding seasonal change.
Mm-hmm.
And you also probably noticed, I mean, look at the way in which the Arctic is increasingly sold to us visually. I mean, how often do we see a picture of a lonely polar bear stranded on a piece of vulnerable ice?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly that Al Gore did in his film, An Inconvenient Truth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're also seeing here is a really important kind of visual politics. You know, like, how do we think about the Arctic? And I think the challenge we have is to somehow connect up that lonely polar bear on a shrinking piece of ice with everything else I've been talking about in the last kind of 40 minutes. But in some cases, the other thing to bear in mind is, for some indigenous communities, climate change is a good thing. It makes life slightly easier.
Mm.
You know, if conditions are slightly warmer or less extreme, that may not be a bad thing. It might enable different kinds of agriculture, for example.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things I'd really want to leave you with is that not everybody necessarily thinks that climate change and instability is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
There can also be positives.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have a couple of minutes left here, and we have some other callers. So next we'll talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. This is mostly just a comment. I I just find it interesting that we always take everything, the way we view the world, so much from our own perspective, which is obviously the easiest way to do it. And I don't know sometimes why we can't just leave some places alone, just to be the way they are and not always feel the need to have to exploit everything out of everything. And that's my comment, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I mean, the thing I would say here is that I think we tend to sometimes think of places like the Arctic and the Antarctic as if they've never changed. The point is, of course, the Arctic is changing. It's a hugely dynamic place. It has done over thousands and millions of years, and it will continue to do so. And what we have to do, I think, is try and distinguish between the kinds of changes that indigenous communities have worked with and lived with for several thousand years, the kind of changes that are due to industrialization and urbanization, particularly over the last couple hundred years, and also the kind of changes that are part of the Earth's natural rhythms and the interaction between the three of them. And I think it's hugely complex when you actually kind of say, well, how is the Arctic changing and how is it likely to be in 50 years' time, 100 years' time? And then to bear in mind that 50 years and 100 years is insignificant when it comes to geological time. It's a pinprick. Mm-hmm. It's nothing.
We'll try to get one more at least. Effingham, line two. Hello?
Yes, we know the symptoms. What are we going to do? Thank you.
That's a pretty broad question, I guess. I don't know how you might want to address it. I assume that what the caller was talking about is climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in a sense, as your listeners will know, Copenhagen next month is going to be yet another opportunity for the world's nations to get together to talk about climate change. The bottom line is this, is that we know, on the assumption that most of your listeners accept that climate change is not some gigantic scientific hoax, that we have to make profound changes to the way in which we kind of coexist with the Earth. The difficulty is, again, as your caller intimated, is whether we're actually going to do that. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to have to confront is that if we continue to consume the resources in the way that those of us living in North America and Europe have done, clearly the scientists are telling us, you know, that the Arctic and the Antarctic in different kinds of ways are going to be radically altered. Mm-hmm. And that has all kinds of implications, as we, I think we all understand fairly well, with regards to ecosystem disruption, sea level rises, and the list goes on. You know, my fear is, I'm afraid, is that we're going to need more dramatic moments and episodes to actually force us to make some really tough choices. And I, for one, I'm afraid I'm extremely skeptical that anything very substantive is going to come out of next month's meeting in Denmark.
Well, we have a couple of minutes here, forgive me for bringing up going back to a sort of a wonky kind of question here at the end. But I guess I find myself wondering, going back to some of the things that we were talking about before, about the Arctic nations, that is, whose nations whose coastline is on the Arctic Sea, and their claims on the territory, and then whatever kind of international claims might be made, whether you think that that, say, the Arctic Five could get together and form form the Arctic Five Compact or something like that, you know, form some kind of body that would say, well, this is our territory and we will make the determination of how it should be protected and how it should be developed and so forth, and that the rest of the world can just, you know, go and worry about something else. And I suppose at the same point, the same time, it would be natural to argue that it would be within the purview of the United Nations to address the same sorts of issues, and how then you know that sort of jockeying of those two potential bodies, a potential body that we would make up by the governments of these countries, and then the rest of the world who would make the argument saying, well, wait a minute, yes, you have some legitimate claims here, but this also is a kind of a common resource, and that everybody should be involved in this conversation about how it's managed.
Yeah. Well, all I can say is that exactly the kind of tension and debate that occurred with regards to the Antarctic in the 1980s. And I think what you have here, in a nutshell, as we're coming towards the end of the program, mm-hmm. is really an explicit tension between the territorial ambitions of five particular countries and, if you like, all the kind of flow-like opportunities and threats that have to be confronted and addressed. And really, there are many Arctics, and any attempt to prioritize one as opposed to the other is going to cause tension and conflict. And really, I think what I'd end with is the thought that those five coastal states, they might want it to be thought of as theirs, but increasingly they're finding that actually it is ours. And the European Union, China, Britain, environmental movements, indigenous communities, the United Nations, and so on, are going to ensure that actually that kind of public debate about not only who owns the Arctic, but also how do we respond to it. And I think the thing that I also would say is, let's also not talk about the Arctic as if we just always talk about it in rational and strategic terms. Let's actually be honest here. When we talk about the Arctic, we also invoke a range of emotions, from fear to pride to humiliation. And I think we kind of need to be honest with ourselves that actually sometimes we lose our minds when we talk about the Arctic. Yeah. It does funny things to us.
The guest this morning here on Focus 580, Klaus Dodds. He's a professor of geopolitics at University of London, and he is here visiting campus to take part in a symposium looking at some of the global security issues raised by climate change and very specifically what's happening in the high Arctic. This is taking place this afternoon on the campus at the Illini Union Building, beginning at 3, and I think anyone interested should feel welcome to stop by. The organizers include the European Union Center, the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security, and also the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center, all here at the U of I. Thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure. Appreciate Thank it. You.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Provena Covenant Medical Center, now an in-network provider for all Health Alliance plans, including HMO, PPO, Point of Service, and Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO. Provena encourages you to join them in supporting WILL. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. That's it for us on Focus, but there is much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about Afghanistan with journalist Malcolm Garcia. His first trip on assignment for the Kansas City Star was made 2 months after September 11th. He made 6 trips between then and 2007. The trips varied in length from weeks to months. Malcolm Garcia will be our guest this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. In Kansas City, December wheat is now trading at 518 and a half, down 8 and a quarter. March, 538, down 5 and a quarter. December wheat in Chicago, 517, down 4. March, 534 and a quarter, down 6 and a half. December corn, 379, down 5. March, 392, down 5 and a half. May, 402, down 5 and a quarter. July, 411 and 3 quarters, down 4. November beans, 968, down 27 and a half. January, 973, down 26. March, 984, down 18 and a half. May, 990 and a half, down 9. July, 994 and a half, down 7 3/4. December meal, $291.50, down $10.10. December oil, $37.14, down 41. December live cattle, 86.37 and a half, up 12 and a half. February, 87.20, down 17 and a half. November feeder cattle, 95.65, up 27 and a half. January, 97 even, up 30. December lean hogs, 57.10, down 70. December crude, $80.07, down 33. The U.S. dollar, 75.75. That is up 11.